The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. It's smart mobile accounting designed specifically for freelancers and small business owners. You can try FreshBooks for 30 days on us with no credit card required. Go to FreshBooks/sports and enter sports in the How You Heard About Us section, FreshBooks.com.
I've always found that very easy because I'm bilingual. I always spoke Italian at home and then spoke English in school and in most professional settings. So it's been very easy. The one trickier thing, actually, and I still struggle with this occasionally, is certain style points. So, for example, in England, on ESPN FC, you know, we might write Arsenal have lost 3 games in a row. In US sports, obviously, you wouldn't say that. I think athletes in American sports, very broadly speaking, I think more is demanded of them, not just physically, but intellectually as well. You see in the NBA, like, you know, when LeBron was in his pomp, people would go and watch that. You tell me, do people who are not fans of the Galaxy tune in to watch Steven Gerrard or Robbie Keane?
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview members of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And my guest this week is the fine soccer writer and analyst, Gabriel Marcati. So hopefully I nailed that. I probably didn't nail Gabriel, but hopefully the Marcati part I got. He, of course, most people I think in the States know, works for ESPN. You could read his stuff on ESPN FC. You see him on ESPN. Also works for the Times of London, the Italian sports publication Corriere della Sport, and the Sunday Herald as well. Author of 3 books, and you know, not surprisingly to anyone who will listen to this, or I shouldn't just make the presumption if you're not into soccer, really one of the foremost experts in the world. Incredibly bright, smart, very thoughtful guy. And I would highly recommend his work and following him on Twitter if you are not already. He is in Zurich as part of the FIFA Congress coverage. So very kind of him to make 45 minutes or so for us on the eve of all the stuff that's happening in Switzerland. So without any further ado, let's go to Gabriel Marcati. That's my horrible Italian attempt to introduce him to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Gab, I know you are in Zurich at the FIFA Congress. I appreciate you giving me a little bit of time on what is a very busy week. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Yeah, thanks. I'm delighted to be here and to make time for you. Obviously, I'm out here with ESPN, and we're kind of going the whole hog on this in terms of coverage. But very happy to make time for my former classmate, as it were, as well.
Way back in the days at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism.
Exactly.
Indeed. This podcast does a lot on process. And so one of the questions I want to start with is media access in world football, because it's very fascinating to me, because the access here in the States is far different in Europe, and I would imagine the access in Europe is far different than Africa, and the access in Africa is far different than Asia. You're one of the great people to talk to about this because you have covered global football. You've been in multiple continents. So you can go as long as you want on this, but as an overall first question, how would you describe media access in world football?
So I think when it comes to media access to primarily to the stars, to players and managers, I think there's two elements, I think, to break in. One is that, and this might be familiar to a lot of people who work stateside, is just because you can talk to somebody doesn't mean that they're going to say anything interesting or worthwhile or deviate from their talking points. And I think that's something that, you know, increasingly clubs have, certainly in football, you know, clubs have generally instilled in the players. So when you talk, you know, you've got the same 3, 4, 5 things that you want to say. It's all pretty, you know, non-controversial, milk toast type stuff. And I think often stuff that's not necessarily super honest either, but it's part of the job. And now the other element is how often you get to talk to these people. And certainly it's less and less. I mean, it's probably, you know, inversely proportional to the size of the team and the interest. But certainly at the bigger clubs, you have to go through the club if you want to speak to anybody on the record. You can if you know the people and the agents, and you've had opportunities, you know, sometimes get to people on background. But at that point, of course, you can't quote them, because if you do, they'll get in trouble. So you do have these sort of very choreographed media opportunities. Everybody complained that, you know, it wasn't like this in the old days. I've been doing this for nearly 20 years. And, you know, 20 years ago, people were saying, well, it wasn't like this in the old days, and it keeps getting worse. So it probably does keep getting worse, and access does keep getting more and more regulated. But, you know, I think to some degree it's the nature of the beast. And I think people are also realizing that, I don't know, all those sort of interviews, Q&As, press conferences, unless the guy either does like a magazine exclusive or a TV exclusive, and it's something, you know, and really devotes himself to it, or he's got something he wants to get off his chest, it's not going to be very, very interesting to the audience. Certainly not interesting to me.
Have you found that there's one high caliber league that's better than another when it comes to access? Meaning, is La Liga better than the Bundesliga? Is the Premier League better than La Liga? Out of the big five global leagues in the world, is there one that is better than another on access, and why?
All right, so if you're talking about official access, in other words, the clubs making people available to you and having somebody, you know, perch there alongside them, my impression is certainly that France and probably Spain, outside of the top clubs, are better. Italy as well. There's just more media demand. And I think a lot of clubs tend to maybe feel more of a responsibility, or maybe, you know, they have to rely on local media more, especially at mid-tier clubs and smaller clubs, less so at bigger clubs. If you're talking, and then by the same token, you know, you don't blame them, because something like Real Madrid or Manchester United, you know, they're going to have a billion requests, and the players would be there continually. In terms of dialoguing with the media, providing information, and what, I guess what you'd call kind of like more stage managed access, I think the Bundesliga does probably a better job. They also tend to be more fair. You know, they're not going to necessarily go and give access to one paper over another paper. They're very concerned about competition and about kind of, you know, making sure everybody feels they've got a fair shake. Now, the other wild card in this is the foreign press, because, you know, if you're a German newspaper and you go to Arsenal and you request something, you're going to have a much better chance than if you're an English guy who's covering Arsenal every day and request something. There's still this idea of kind of, you know, reaching foreign audiences, foreign markets, pushing your brand abroad.
That's interesting, and that's very true when it comes to the Bundesliga in the States, in that league has really given American publications some incredible access, including Sports Illustrated. So that's an interesting observation by you. If you are going to cover one of the, I think you, I don't know if you are now, I know you have been based in London. If you were going to cover one of the London clubs, can you take the listeners through what a game day would be like for you in terms of what your preparation is, and then what kind of access you may or may not get to anybody?
So the typical access on a match day, I mean, and I am based in London. What I do is probably a bit different from others. But you know, generally you would, and this has been talked about as being one of the issues of covering sports, but you would generally show up at the stadium, say the Emirates, maybe 45 minutes or an hour before kickoff. You would hang out and snack with other members of the media. You would go into the press box where you'd have a little table and maybe a little TV and you know, a PowerPoint and stuff. You'd write your report, and then afterwards there would be a press conference with the two managers. Very rarely would they bring in a player. That works a bit differently. That's in the Premier League. That works a bit differently elsewhere in Europe, and certainly in Spain and Italy and in England, in Germany, you would get as well what they call a mix zone, which basically the media kind of they line up behind this little fence or dividing barrier like the police would have. The players walk past, and sometimes you can request the player, and the press officer will say, like, well, see if he wants to talk. If you know the guy or if he's in a good move, you know, you'll say, like, hey, can you come over? And you'll come over and you'll answer a few questions. But, of course, it's always in a setting where you're surrounded by other media, so you're never getting anything exclusive, really. And also a lot of times the players just, you know, the traditional thing to do is to walk through pretending you're talking on your cell phone or walk through wearing your Beats by Dre headphones. So, you know, they're totally oblivious.
As someone who has worked for and does work for multiple publications, and I think most of the people stateside obviously read you on ESPN, so they're familiar with your work there, but that's not the only place you work for, and we mentioned that at the top. How do you decide what you're writing about on a week-to-week basis? Do you get assignments from editors and they say, please write this, or are you at the point where you make pitches every week, or you let your employers know, here's what I'm going to be writing about every week?
So, I mean, the main publications, I mean, it varies from publication to publication. When I write for Corriere dello Sport, which is the Italian paper I write for, it's almost always, you know, assigned stuff. I'll pitch things occasionally, and it's usually to do with the Premier League. With the Times, where I'm a European football correspondent, I'll generally, you know, I'll just generally have an idea, and they'll generally let me write what I want. With ESPN, there I'll cover more games, you know, more news stories. For example, I'm here in Zurich for ESPN covering FIFA. So there'll be a little more direction around events, but beyond that, they're generally very, very good to me, and they tend to trust my judgment. So I'll generally, you know, have a discussion with them about what angle I want to take or you know, what reporting I've done, and they're very good about, you know, giving feedback and kind of letting me do my own thing.
Is it, or I should say, how tough is it to morph from English to Italian? Just in terms of writing, in terms of your brain processing information in one language versus another language?
I've always found that very easy because I'm bilingual. I always spoke Italian at home and then spoke English in school and most professional settings. So that's been very easy. The one trickier thing, actually, and I still struggle with this occasionally, is certain style points. So, for example, in England, and on ESPN FC, you know, we might write, Arsenal have lost three games in a row. You kind of treat Arsenal, I guess, as a collective noun. In U.S. sports, obviously, you wouldn't say that. You know, you would say Cleveland, for example, you know, has lost three games in a row. When I worked for the Wall Street Journal, they kept that sort of American style in their soccer coverage. So I'd always find myself kind of adjusting to that. And sometimes it was a bit difficult and then tricky to keep up with.
Who, and this doesn't have to be just one a solo answer, Gab. It could be multiple people, you know, and feel free to expand on whoever you want. But Who would you say right now are the most compelling people to interview in world football?
Wow. I think generally it's probably not players, or it's probably not a lot of the top players, because they tend to be, like we said, they tend to be guarded and so on. I mean, I've been fortunate and I interviewed him tons of times. I wrote a book with him, with Paolo Di Canio, for example, who is a really compelling three-dimensional character as a player, and then later, controversially, as a manager. Now that, for a writer, that's just like a gift, because whether you like him or not, it's an extremely interesting person. With the managers, with managers, it's certainly more managers than players. I found Jose Mourinho when he's not acting, but sometimes when he is acting and sometimes when he's not acting. Yeah, Jose Mourinho is box office, and he's interesting. He's extremely interesting. Pep Guardiola, I interviewed Pep right at the very end of his career. He was in Qatar. And to this day, it's one of the best, most significant interviews I feel I've done. And incidentally, in no way prescient that he would become one of the greatest managers in the world, because, he basically came out and said, football's changed. There's no place for people like me. There's no place for us. Everything evolves, and we have to find something else to do, and blah, 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 which is all kind of ironic. Sir Alex Ferguson, one of my absolute favorite interviews, Arsene Wenger. It's generally managers, but when you interview somebody, I either want somebody to talk, X's and O's in an interesting way, and most players tend not to do that, or I want somebody who's a great character, and sometimes the great characters can be obscure. Footballers or obscure athletes, it's not necessarily going to be the best guys.
Is there someone right now in the sport who is considered the toughest get, whether it's you or Grant Wall or someone else who covers global football? This person, whether it's a player or a manager, just happens to be at the moment the toughest person to really get an hour or 2 hours worth of time?
Well, I think it would probably be Pep Guardiola. I know, certainly if you're talking one-on-ones, or actually he's a character as well. Marcelo Bielsa, who is the former Argentina and Chile and Marseille and Atletico Bilbao coach.
Right.
He's one of the most erudite, interesting people to talk to in press conferences, and he'll have press conferences where he'll talk forever and answer every question, but he doesn't do one-on-ones. So if you're, if you were to profile him and try to turn him into some kind of three-dimensional guy and find out about his private life or what he does in his free time, it would be extremely, extremely difficult to do.
You are someone who works globally, meaning that you work for different employers at different times. And so I'm wondering, when you are, let's say, working for ESPN, is there a certain style, and we've certainly seen you on television in addition to writing, is there a certain style that you have for an American audience that would be different than, let's say, when you're writing for the Italian audience? And could you expand on just how you shift and morph into different roles depending on who your audience is?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, right now, I'm on staff at ESPN, so in my day-to-day, that's kind of my main thing. It's a really good point you make about the audience. I always try to look at it from the audience's perspective, and sometimes I get it wrong. And I'm also very cognizant that what I like might not be what the mainstream likes. But I'll give you an example. In England a few years ago, I was one of the studio analysts for the Champions League highlight show, which goes out on terrestrial TV and is very, very mainstream. And there I had to assume that, our audience, they would know the English teams and English players, but they wouldn't know much about the foreign teams. So I had to kind of continually explain things because those were casual fans. When I do ESPN FC, for example, I kind of think that our audience is actually quite knowledgeable. So I can kind of speak on a slightly different level. You always have to, I think, be aware of kind of the shared culture that you have with your readers or with your listeners, whether you know, you're on TV or writing or on radio. And so in Italy, you know, you're writing for that audience. I'll always make it a point to, you know, remind people that, you know, Arsenal's in North London, and which is stuff that obviously wouldn't do when working for the Times.
How what kind of access does ESPN open up abroad? I'm always it's always fascinating to me the power that the Sports Illustrated brand has away from America. Not only fascinating, I'm actually thankful for it, because I think some of that is still a little bit of the power that the brand had in the 80s and the 90s. And I think a lot of Europeans, certainly of a certain age, learned of the brand then. And, you know, someone like Grant Wall benefits from that if he goes to Barca and wants to interview people there or goes to Brazil. So for you, I'm curious, as an ESPN staffer, when you are, let's say, in Munich or you're in, you know, you're in Cairo, does it open doors the way it would open doors in the States, or is it different? Does it not carry that global weight?
So I think in terms of brand recognition, it's huge, because also, you know, U.S. sports, whether it's the NFL or the NBA, are very popular around the world, and a lot of that is directly associated with ESPN, even for U.S. sports, where maybe ESPN doesn't own the properties. So, you know, in countries where ESPN don't have a presence, I still find that it's something that, you know, everybody is familiar with. In countries like in Latin America and whatever else, where it does have a presence locally, even though they understand that, you know, it's not, you know, ESPN Mexico or whatever, but it's ESPN FC, it's or .com. I think it has helped. Within Europe, it's a bit difficult for me to answer, because, you know, like I said, I've been doing this thing a long time. So a lot of times when I try to get access, you know, the people I talk to tend to know me. And you know, the fact that it's ESPN may be a bonus, but you know, I generally, it's, you know, my relationships with people are generally more of a factor. And I should also specify, though, it's not like I'm calling these guys up and saying, like, you know, I want 45 minutes with Thomas Muller juggling bananas. You know, it doesn't. I don't normally ask for those types of. I don't impose to that level with the kind of stuff I do.
I really like the extended notes may not be the right way to phrase that, but the column that you do for ESPN FC, where you take, like, you know, 10 different either issues or matches that have happened, and you sort of offer your own perspective and reported analysis. I think that's a really interesting column, and it's interesting to read. I find myself getting educated by it. When you're doing this kind of extended columns, multiple topics, how long does something like that take you to prepare? Because it's not only analysis, sometimes it's reporting, and it covers a lot of ground and covers a lot of different leagues.
So I thought when you asked me that question, you were going to ask me whether the inspiration of it was Peter King.
Similar and different, yeah.
I would have said, no, that is definitely the, I mean, I'm a big fan of his writing, and that was definitely, you know, the starting point. You know, let's try to give somebody, because I think there is such a thing. I don't think people are just fans of one league or one team. They like to be across, you know, the bigger teams around Europe. So it is box office driven. I always try to have something that's maybe, you know, a little slightly unusual, but obviously Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern, United, Juventus, they tend to be in there a lot of the time. Generally what I do is I have a pretty decent setup at home. So I only actually get to go to a game, if it's Arsenal or Chelsea at home, on a Saturday because the stadiums are very easy for me to get to. Otherwise, I spend a lot of time at home and I watch a lot of games. I watch every single weekend. I watch Real Madrid and Barcelona and Bayern, plus a couple games from Serie A and at least three or four games from the Premier League. And I think it's really key to watch the games as well in person and take notes and notice things, see if then they turn up in the reporting elsewhere. And I think that's kind of what gives you some context. I can read German, French, Spanish, and Italian, which makes it easier as well. I'll go see, if people said things after games, I'll try to contextualize it. Often there's people I can call who might be familiar with a situation or a theme, and I'll try to put some of that in. It's kind of like an ongoing project, which, sort of tends to start on Saturday and generally finishes around 2 o'clock Monday afternoon when I file, and I take breaks to do the ESPN FC show Sunday night, and I take bathroom breaks, but otherwise sleep breaks. Otherwise, it is pretty much a continuous thing.
It's a very impressive group of languages that you are facile with. Let's take a break with Mr. Marcati, and we'll be back right after this. Listen, all the great sports teams historically have had incredible support systems, both from upper management to the players on the field, on the ice, in the arena. And the same goes for your business, and FreshBooks is here to help. Everyone, I shouldn't say everyone, but a lot of people obviously struggle when it comes to bookkeeping and taxes. And for the best way to manage your books and make tax season easy, get FreshBooks, which is a super intuitive tool that makes creating and sending invoices extremely simple for freelancers and small business owners. FreshBooks stands out where it really counts. That's getting you paid. You can create and send professional invoices in just 30 seconds. You'll see exactly when your client looked at the invoice you've emailed, tracking the status of all your outstanding invoices. FreshBooks can even send late payment reminders to your clients automatically, which means you're not wasting time chasing down and fighting clients for payment. The results speak for themselves. FreshBooks users get paid 5 days faster on average. But don't just take my word for it. Right now, FreshBooks is offering my listeners 30 days of unrestricted use, totally free, and you don't need a credit card to sign up. What do? Just go to FreshBooks.com/sports and enter sports in the How You Heard About Us section. That's FreshBooks.com/sports. Enter sports in the How You Heard About Us section. Check out FreshBooks.com. All right, we are back with Gab, and we'll sort of finish up with some questions that Bette Marston, my producer, and I received from Twitter when we mentioned that Gab was going to be our guest. And one of the interesting questions, we'll start with this, is from a T. Bingham, and this was an MLS-related question, but it pertains to global soccer as well, so you're a really good person to ask this. And the question revolved around the idea that part of MLS's appeal is that it's a relatively level playing field, many different champions over its 20 years. And one, do you see that changing in the future? And two, how important, if it is indeed important, is it to stay away from two or three or four teams dominating the way they often can dominate in European leagues?
See, this is a great question, and this is one of those kind of age-old, like, how long is a piece of string type debates where I honestly don't know. I don't know the answer. On the one hand, there are people who will tell you that, golf was never as popular and as mainstream as when Tiger Woods was dominant, and that the NBA really hit its stride when you had three teams, and yes, I'm including the Sixers in that, dominating early on. Obviously with those the great Lakers Celtics rivalry, nobody else was getting a look at, right? And that's something that sustained itself for a long time, right? For a decade. And so there is an argument to that. One thing I've been told, and I don't have access to the ratings, so it may be apocryphal, is, for example, with MLS, what tends to happen is, while the teams are very popular in their own market, and you know, and I've been to games in three different MLS stadiums, and I thought they were good and entertaining, and they'll do well on TV locally. I'm told that what often tends to happen is that, like, the big game of the week, if your team isn't involved in it, you might not watch. You might go do something else. Whereas, like, if you're an Aston Villa fan and it's, you know, Manchester United against Arsenal, you'll still watch the game. I've been told that that's not the case, or my impression is that is not the case in MLS. The parity and the turnover of teams, yeah, I mean, you always have a chance, but you don't necessarily build up the brands or the super teams, which, you know, might be good in some ways, but in other ways, you know, you kind of lose sort of that instant path. You know, imagine if, you know, the Red Bulls, when they got Marquez and Thierry Henry, imagine they'd become outstanding immediately and dominated MLS for the whole time he was there and everything. And you know, might that have driven the league forward in a different way? I don't know. There's smarter marketing people who would know, would give the answer. But certainly my impression is that, you know, there's a trade-off, and you kind of need to do what works for you. Certainly, you know, here in the NBA, like, you know, when LeBron was in his pomp, people would go and watch that. You tell me, do like people who are not fans of the Galaxy tune in to watch Steven Gerrard or Robbie Keane?
They do not.
And I think maybe that's part of the issue.
Let me ask you,
K. Kamara or whatever. You know?
Well, at least in terms of sort of casual sports fans, do not as a general rule tune into MLS games. You know, you respect the diehard fans of the league, but the one of the big problems with the league is that they never really get any crossover people. The one time that does happen is when the World Cup exists, a little bit with European Championships, etc. But it's been a tough viewership draw.
But what I'm curious, but do the diehards watch the other top MLS teams?
Oh, that I understand what you're saying. That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I would think that so much of that would have to do with time and place, whether they if the game is on at a comfortable time for that viewer. But I'm not sure. I would tend to say it's not destination viewing, even for the diehard MLS fan.
Yeah.
I think they still would tend to watch their team, as opposed to, like, the, like, as you made a great point, like, if LeBron is on or the Thunder are on TNT, even if you're not a Thunder fan, you think it's kind of cool to watch Durant and Westbrook play together.
Right.
Let me ask you just a quick question about sort of competitiveness, because I think you would have a really interesting take on this. Where would the champion of MLS place in the Premier League? Would they be out of a relegation zone? Would they be a relegation team? Or would your contention be that they wouldn't even be a Premier League team? They'd have to go one level down.
So for this one, I have to rely on people who watch more MLS than I do and people who've moved to MLS. And the very broad consensus that people tell me is that, you know, the level is, you know, the MLS champion might be a playoff team in the championship. Hmm. I don't know. What I find fascinating is that you get people who are pretty good and, you know, still have a lot to give in Europe, and they come to MLS and they don't work out.
Right.
And you've got other people who, you know, were pretty terrible in Europe. You know, if Bradley Wright Phillips is listening, I hope he doesn't get upset when I say this, but then, you know, they come to MLS and they're superstars, you know, to a level that you wouldn't have expected. I think with MLS, I mean, and there's great examples of this, and we'll plug Grant's book on Beckham, but when you look at the travel schedule, the training schedule, it's just a huge leap for a lot of guys who maybe were, you know, were used to playing top flight football in Europe. And I think the culture shock perhaps gets to them a little bit.
How do you stay, who do you read globally to stay current? And I realize that may be too big a list, but are on a given day, and I think people who are listening to this will obviously be soccer fans and readers, they would love to know sort of what's part of your daily digest in terms of consuming the sport.
So I'm increasingly interested in kind of what goes on and why things happen. I always feel that, like, you know, if you're going to critique the way a team plays or a manager, it's pretty important to know what the manager was trying to do. And you can ask a manager what the game plan was after the game, but, you know, the manager often won't tell you. So the way you gain that access is by speaking to people on background. And that's something I've really cultivated over the last 5 or 6 years, to the point where, you know, I think I have a decent enough access at most clubs where I can speak to somebody who can kind of tell me, yeah, this is what we're trying to do right now, or this is kind of what's going on, and that's why we're doing things this way or that way. So I try to look for other people who can fill in those gaps on the news side. Guillaume Balaguer, who is a Spanish journalist who writes for us and for Sky Sports in England, he's very good in that regard. Rafael Honigstein is my go-to guy for German stuff. Who also writes for ESPN, occasionally appears on our TV show. In England, Daniel Taylor from The Guardian, I think is very, very good. Neil Ashton from The Daily Mail, Ollie Kay from my paper from The Times, Matt Hughes also from The Times. And then I also like people who are great at writing features and write interesting stories. And in that category, there's certainly Sid Lowe, you know, among English speakers, Sid Lowe from The Guardian, Rory Smith from The Times. You're making me say names, so I'm sure I'm forgetting people.
But it's so far a very good list. I mean, everybody on that list is really top flight.
Yeah, those guys are generally, you know, I think really good people. Sam Waller, Henry Winter, Martin Samuel, I think is a really sharp thinker, although I often disagree with him. There's a decent bunch of people. I mean, I think one of the risks, and it's slightly different, you know, if you're talking about the media in Europe compared to the U.S., and as you know, I'm a consumer of U.S. sports too, where certainly, you know, there's national coverage, but there's obviously really, really strong local coverage. You don't have that as much, if at all, in Europe. And so, you know, maybe the top guys might have a broader and greater familiarity with four or five top teams, but maybe, you know, less of sort of that vertical familiarity that, you know, say, like, New England Patriots or Philadelphia Eagles beat reporter might have. So I think it affects the coverage in some ways.
Jose Umana asks of you, do you have any recommendations for young soccer writers on how to get jobs, and specifically, should going to Europe or South America be an option?
So I get asked this a lot. And other, I'd say in addition to the common, you know, the common answers about, I think it's still essential to know the nuts and bolts of reporting and writing. There's a lot of bloggers out there and whatever else, and they fill a service, but I think you can only get, I think you can only really make it if you're that sort of writer, if you are just absurdly talented as a writer. If you're not, you have to have the reporting to go with it. So that part out of the way, which probably most old school journalists would tell you. One recommendation I would make to everybody is the game is so integrated. You want to be able to talk to people in their language, or at least listen to them in their language. I tell everybody, you know, if you're a native English speaker, learn Spanish if you're going to cover soccer, and vice versa. And if you're lucky enough to have those languages, then pick up French or German or Portuguese. That helps you immeasurably. Now, going somewhere else and reporting back to the U.S., or it's something that, yeah, I think increasingly people are doing. I think it's difficult to do. There's a lot of logistical issues with it. I don't know that it's a permanent career path, but you will learn a lot if you do that. And if you challenge yourself doing that.
All right, a couple more here for you. How difficult or easy is covering the FIFA Congress or FIFA in general when you are in Switzerland? And we are now talking to you. You're in Zurich. You're covering this FIFA Congress. Obviously, it's not just sports news. It's A1 news. Is it? And you're with 400 other journalists. So that's, you know, almost has a Super Bowl like feel to me. So how do you go in there and produce something or get something that's even mildly different than somebody else?
So I think the way you can provide value added, it's extremely, you're not going to break stories unless you're extremely talented or you cover, you know, sort of football governance all the time. And there are some people who do that. In some ways, it's easier because all these people have a cloud of friends, hangers-on, consultants surrounding them, and these people talk all the time. A large number of football executives are actually very accessible. You can text them, you can grab them when they go in and out of hotels or whatever else. So in that sense, you can, you know, if you speak to a wide enough range of people, you can generally get a sense of what's going on. In terms of the Congress itself, you know, we're going to be sitting perched up in a media tribune looking down, and, you know, we're realistically going to get similar access than you would watching the stream or watching it on TV if it's on. So in that sense, it's, you're not going to get a lot more. The value added, I think, comes from the insight. But the other thing that's a bit difficult, too, is people generally understand the horse trading aspects to it, but there is an enormous cultural gap as well, especially when it comes to FIFA. It's the Anglo world, the U.S. And England especially, you know, has kind of almost written off FIFA as like a bad thing, rife with corruption or whatever. And there's obviously strong issues and problems with corruption that need to be cleaned up. And they fail to understand why people keep voting for the same people time and again. So one of the things I focused on was telling the story of, you know, I mean, this happened to me when I was in Brazil. I met this guy who, you know, he's from a small African country. And basically his country's FA effectively runs on the grant money that they get from FIFA and from CAF. That's what, you know, pays for their away trips. That's what pays for their youth program. That's what pays for their girls' soccer program. And this is a country that's never going to qualify for the World Cup. They're probably never going to qualify for the African Nations Cup either. But he said, you know, we were kind of ignored for a long, long time. Until Sepp Blatter came along and the Goal program or whatever else. And so, whereas we in the West see it as purely patronage, and, you know, giving money in exchange for votes, they view it in a different light. And I think to some degree you have to be cognizant of that, and you have to be aware of that. In the same way that, you know, this latest business with, you know, Florida Lane and that whole scandal. You know, we in the West, we call it the great FIFA scandal or whatever else. Well, you know, I think apart from Jerome Valk, nobody from no actual FIFA employee has been indicted. All those people that you read about, all those guys you saw getting arrested, those guys were people who might have held positions at FIFA because they were sent there by their confederations in, you know, CONCACAF and CONMEBOL in South America. Those guys are accused of crimes and misdeeds to do not with FIFA tournaments, but with tournaments in the Americas. And yet the narrative is that this is a FIFA scandal. And of course you can blame FIFA for the culture and the lack of oversight. And I would totally agree with that. But it's just interesting to see this sort of sharp divide in the narrative. And it's almost as if the, you know, even among the media here, it's almost as if they're speaking two different languages, coming at it from two very radically different vantage points.
That's interesting. I mean, we could probably do, you know, 5 hours on FIFA and this particular Congress. But that's really interesting. All right, let's finish up with this. One more question. We'll let Gab go because it's going to be a busy 48 hours for him. Salvador Carmona wanted to get your take on the football analytics community, which right now in soccer is rather small, but has a lot of growth and is kind of fascinating to think about given how much basketball has sort of exploded with analytics. Baseball, we know, has sort of been the forerunner, at least in the States. And, you know, we're seeing it explode in football as well. Hockey's analytics now are up. So where do you see the role of analytics in soccer, at least for your perspective, in global soccer, maybe away from MLS?
So there's two points to make to this. One is that my first kind of introduction to this came through my friend Chris Anderson, and actually I'll be chairing a symposium with him at MIT at the Sloan Analytics Conference next month. Chris was an economics professor at Cornell, and he wrote a book on analytics and started consulting with different teams, and now he works for Coventry City in England. And he's got this wonderful turn of phrase, which is that if you were to compare analytics in football with the history of medicine, we would be right at the stage where we're still using leeches to draw blood. In other words, we know nothing. Everything is still rudimentary, trial and error. And this is an analytics guy saying it. And you have to have that humility that this is a different sport. There's different measurables. You can gain an advantage. You believe that, but you have to, you know, approach it with the right frame of mind. And I think some of the best analytics guys out there aren't those guys who got certainties, but they're guys who understand percentages and likelihoods and things like that. I think one big hurdle, other than the obvious hurdle in the nature of the game and the fluidity of the game, or two big hurdles, actually, I'll give you in soccer that make things more complicated. One, and I'm sure if you like analytics, you'll know what I mean, is that I think score effects have a tremendous influence on soccer, more so than on those other sports you cited. And more frustratingly, score effects work in different ways in different countries. In England and in Germany, if you score, the team that scores first is more likely to score a second goal. In Spain, France, and Italy, the team that scores first is more likely to concede a goal. Mm. And I think that's down to, like I said, score effects and the way you know, athletes behave when they're ahead or behind on the pitch in different countries. And then there's a cultural matrix, perhaps, that influences that. The other thing worth noting, I think, is, and the reason it's catching on a lot more slowly in soccer, even though it is growing, but in Europe it still becomes an issue, I think simply has to do, and I hope people take this the right way, it has to do with education. So in U.S. sports, you know, we joke about dumb jocks and whatever, but, you know, the vast majority of professional athletes in the United States are college educated. The smartest ones out of those might go and become general managers and be clever enough to be able to, or coaches or whatever, and be clever enough to go and hire the smartest analytics guys. but they've got the basic building blocks in terms of understanding math and statistics. You know, you don't have to, you don't have to be a genius in it, but you need to have a mind for it, right? In soccer, that's not the case. In soccer, if you become a professional, you generally effectively stop studying at 16. There obviously are some college-educated guys, but there aren't very many, and you know, there's very few who even have high school degrees. And I think those 2-3 years of math that are missing, I think that has an impact. I know some very intelligent managers. I've tried to introduce them to analytics. You know, some take it, some don't. You know, and I try to explain what a standard deviation is, and they simply don't understand it. It's very difficult for them to think in that way if they haven't thought in that way at all, and they don't have that spatial or analytical or that numbers thinking, because it may be analytical in other ways, in the toolkit. And I think that's a very, very difficult bridge to cross. But I think in time, it'll come. One other aspect, which I think is worth noting, which never ceases to amaze me, is that I think athletes in American sports, very broadly speaking, I think more is demanded of them, not just physically, but intellectually as well. I'm fascinated how, you know, you can take like a 20-year-old defensive back at, you know, Arizona State, who maybe isn't a very good academic student, and you can make him memorize a 150-page playbook, and he'll do it, and he'll be able to apply it in a game situation. I can tell you, again, anecdotally speaking, the people in soccer, you know, you've got international footballers with 60 caps who forget basic instructions that they were given minutes before kickoff. Soccer players tend to train less. They tend never to, they don't do film study, many of them do very little film study. They spend less hours at the training facility. Less is demanded of them, I think, intellectually. And I think that's another frontier that I think soccer can move towards, you know, perhaps hand in hand with analytics.
That's really, really interesting stuff. And I think if there's a major club that that goes down the analytics road, that's a great book for somebody to see, to examine that on a cultural level, and then to see if you're able to fundamentally change people within the sport if you bring analytics to a certain club. And obviously then it gets into you have to try to bring in the right players who can adopt to that kind of thinking and data, et cetera. So that's really interesting stuff.
It's chicken and egg, Rich, because the reality is, you know, soccer players grow up effectively almost training like adults from the age of 16, right, or younger even. If you get those guys early enough and you get them used to, you know, film study, thinking more, and whatever, you know, outside the actual training environment, then, you know, you could create the framework for them to really benefit from more demanding analytics when they become pros. But without that, it's very, very tough.
The guest has been the fine soccer writer and analyst, Gabriel Marcati. He writes for and appears on ESPN, also the Times of London, the Italian publication Corriere dello Sport. I'm pretty close there, right? And then
close enough.
And the Sunday Herald, you are still part of, is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. Did I miss any other employer that we should give a plug to?
No, those are the main ones.
All right. You don't own a Subway or McDonald's franchise somewhere, right? You don't want me to no other employers.
No, not for the time being. I have written 3 books, but that was also time ago. So, I think we've done enough plugging for
that.
We've
covered that. That's good. All right. And listen, first of all, I appreciate the time. It's an incredibly busy week for you. I wish you the best of luck covering the FIFA Congress as you know, both of us know from Colombia, I would, you know, I might trust but verify any human being you talk to in that Congress, because you never know what's going to come down the pike. And it should...
Does that include the Colombia professor who's here, who sits on the FIFA Expo as the U.S. representatives?
Yes, it does. It would include both our mothers as well. You know, trust but verify. I speak for a lot of people here at Sports Illustrated. We certainly enjoy your writing and your work, and no doubt there's a lot of soccer fans in the States who do as well. Gab, continued success. It's great to catch up with you, and thanks so much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks. Pleasure's all mine.
Martina Navratilova is the guest on the Edge of Sports podcast with Dave Zirin. This promises to be a really good conversation. Martina talking about her early life in Czechoslovakia, her defection to the United States, the current state of politics in her adopted country. Martina is always a good interview, and Dave Zirin is a good questioner. So find the Edge of Sports podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or at edgeofsportspodcast.com. All right, back in the studio, we'll wrap this up very quick. My thanks to Gab Marcotti. Everybody always gets on me because I find every interview that I do interesting. Well, you know, obviously I'm choosing these people because I find them interesting. But the stuff on, I'm really fascinated by the differences, Bet, between like how soccer is covered like in certain countries versus the U.S. and what kind of access you get or what kind of access you can't get. And he's a guy who's just traveled the world and seeing that. And then the analytics thing was really fascinating.
I love the analytics part. He was just like, yeah, I've tried to explain it, and it really just doesn't like cross their minds. Whereas like that is the hottest thing to, you know, to cut, you know, that is the hottest way to cover sports in the States right now.
Yeah.
So I found that totally fascinating. And I really appreciate that he did mention how helpful it is for him to be bilingual. I mean, that's certainly something that is truly invaluable for journalists, especially global journalists like Gab. And
The one question I wish I had asked him honestly was how lucrative can covering global soccer be? I don't know if he would have told me how much he makes, but like with those kind of skills, you could really work. He could essentially work for anybody in the world, which is like
He dictates his own editorial calendar now. Yeah. He can dictate. Well,
trust me, there's a reason he's working in London. He's hurting for cashish. All right. Thanks to Gab Marcotti, he explains.
Marcotti.
There you go. Previous podcast guests, we thank Jimmy Traina, Jay Williams, the ESPN college basketball analyst, and Holly Rowe. Coming up, we'll have some really good guests. Not going to announce anybody at the moment, other than Ken Burns, who is booked for March. Bet, who has a big documentary on Jackie Robinson, and he should be really interesting. All right. My producer is Bet Marston. The executive producer of this stuff is Dan Bloom. My thanks, as always, to Ben Eagle, Ryan Hunt, and Paul Fichtenbaum. I'm Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.